Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, we speak with our Pentagon correspondent about Russia's airstrikes in Syria. Hear about a change for the Palestinians at the United Nations. We chat with our cyber expert about Thailand's plan to build a massive internet firewall.
That would allow them to conduct, really rigorous surveillance.
And the hula hoop goes round and round in the world of music. It's here on The Voice of America. Russia has begun conducting airstrikes in Syria and asked U.S. aircraft to avoid Syrian airspace. The U.S. says no. Following all this is correspondent Carla Babb, who joins us on the line. Hi, Carla.
Hi, Susan.
Well, this is a surprise to many. What's going on?
This is a surprise. According to a U.S. official that just spoke with me minutes ago, a Russian general approached a U.S. official at the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad. And that general said that Russia would begin anti-Islamic State airstrikes in Syria today. He asked the U.S. official to have U.S. members remain clear of Syrian airspace, to remove any ground troops. Of course, the United States does not have any ground troops in Syria. And the U.S. official took that and reported it back. And then we've since heard from a spokesperson from the State Department that the U.S. says that they are going to continue to fly their missions over Iraq and Syria. And as we've seen with the U.S. Conducting an airstrike in Aleppo today, that is what they've continued to do.
Well, Carla, do you have any confirmation from the U.S. government that the Russians are actually bombing ISIL positions and not anti-Assad positions?
No, quite the contrary. I just heard from a U.S. official that said that they're striking in homes. The targets are unknown, but it is fair to say, according to the official, that the target is not the Islamic State. The Islamic State is focused in the areas of Raqqa, Deir ez-Zor, Aleppo. Homs is not a place where the Islamic State is. However, Homs is a place where a lot of anti-Assad supporters and anti-Assad fighters are. So the United States and this official did tell me that they do not have any confirmation of what the target is, but they are very sure by deduction, that was another direct quote from him, that the strikes are not anti-Islamic State.
Well, what official statements have you gotten in the past about Russian military involvement in Syria?
Well, this has all come about very quickly. The presidents of Russia and the United States just met on Monday. Secretary Carter then went to his staff and said that Russia conversations would begin to avoid any sort of deconfliction. Deconfliction is just you don't want people to be in the same airspace. You don't want an accident to happen because any miscalculation between two nuclear superpowers could be catastrophic. So that was supposed to begin, and then we heard this morning. So I think the United States is kind of taken by surprise on how quickly Russia has been moving.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Carla. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
ISIL was the focus of a summit in New York. VOA's Victor Beatty has more on that. Welcome, Victor.
Hello, Susan. Well, on the sidelines of the 70th UN General Assembly session in New York, President Obama told the summit that, in general, the battle will be long and punctuated by both success and setback. Terrorism expert Greg Barton of Australia's Deakin University, who attended the New York summit, told me he's encouraged that both Russia and the U.S. are now talking about a political solution to the conflict in Syria.
The big issue, of course, was meeting with Putin. The clear takeaway was, although Barack Obama and Vladimir Putin disagreed on many things, they did agree that working with the existing administration in Syria to work towards a post-Assad administration and an end of the civil war was a necessary immediate step towards a longer struggle against Islamic State. There was an opening to work together on negotiating with Damascus for a regime, well, at least a change of leadership and working with the existing government apparatus to end the civil war and move on to the fight against Islamic State.
Well, do you get a sense that this coalition will actually be effective and that there is a real commitment to combating the IS threat?
You do get a sense that there's a very strong commitment, not because of idealism or sincere intellectual insight so much as because of self-interest. I think nations like Malaysia, Prime Minister Najib spoke quite passionately, as we heard from the leader of Nigeria and indeed the vast array of Muslim-majority states. The realization is that this is a problem that's not going away. It's taking away the youth. It's radicalizing people in a way that we have no answer to, and we need to do something more than what we have been doing.
He did talk about this being more than just having a military solution to it.
Oh, absolutely. I think that was the one takeaway. This language of countering violent extremism, engaging with the ideas, engaging with community groups upstream to try and prevent radicalization, engaging downstream to work towards disengagement and rehabilitation. I think that 12 months ago, that was, at the last UN Assembly meeting, there wasn't the same buy-in. I think 12 months, a lot has changed. We've all recognized that the threat posed by the Islamic State movement is something that's not going to be removed by military means or police means or prosecution. We need to be much more clever. It's basically a return to the hearts and minds campaign of trying to dissuade and discourage and to disengage. This time around, I think pretty much the entire planet is on one position on this.
And Barton says, in order to avoid the mistake the U.S. made in prematurely dismantling Iraq's power structure following the U.S.-led invasion of 2003, the international community is coming to realize it will have to deal with the existing Syrian government, even though President Bashar al-Assad, accused of widespread atrocities, must eventually be removed from power.
Thank you, Victor, for that report.
All right, Susan.
President Obama pointed out at the ISIL summit that there are socioeconomic and political grievances that push young Muslims to join terrorist organizations. International Edition's Mohammed El-Shenawy spoke with Anthony Cordesman, a prominent strategic expert at the Center for International and Strategic Studies, about the summit's recommendations to counter ISIS. And he was not so optimistic, right, Mohammed?
Yes, Sue, and for specific reasons. For example, while he acknowledged that there is a big impact of these grievances on radicalizing young Muslims, he argued that dealing with such socioeconomic problems would not eradicate radicalism.
The interviews that you have with fighters often show that they are motivated by socioeconomic factors. They also show that ideology can be a factor. It's often very, very difficult to separate them. That's why so many of the studies of the causes of terrorism that try to figure out why the people who actually do become extremists, draw such different conclusions as to whether this is a matter of religion, social alienation, which may have little to do with traditional socioeconomic factors, just individuals caught up in anything from deep family problems to tensions that involve really a process of maturity. You look at individuals and you don't see some fixed, predictable pattern of causes.
There was another summit in New York between President Obama and Russian President Putin that focused on how to end the conflict in Syria to help uproot the Islamic State group. But the future role of Syrian President Assad was a sticking point.
On that, too, Anthony Cordesman was so pessimistic because he believes that both the United States-Russian discussion and the UN debate missed the point, as he explains.
Defeating ISIS would still leave the Kurds, leave the Sunni fighters that are not in ISIS, leave the Alawites, and leave the remnants of the Syrian security forces with all of the outside influences around Syria. Now, there is no clear strategy here. Again, even if you got the volunteers, how much of a difference would it make? Even if you could get Assad to leave, but you had all of the same factions, why would that bring peace or order to Syria? I think these are issues that people need to be far more frank about. And quite frankly, listening to the speeches at the UN, it wasn't clear that anyone had a convincing answer to the tragedy that's built up in Syria.
Cordesman insists that while ISIS' major assets are in Syria, uprooting its fighters or the departure of Assad would not bring peace and stability to Syria.
Well, thank you, Mohammed.
Thank you, sir.
Today's Russian airstrikes in Syria have drawn condemnation on social media from the main moderate Syrian opposition group. Michael Lippin is here with more on that. And Michael, what did the group say about the Russian actions?
Hi, Susan. Well, the group we're talking about here is the National Coalition of Syrian Revolution and Opposition Forces. Its Twitter handle is @SYRCoalition, and it's got 12,000 followers. It tweeted a message from its president, Khaled Khoja, condemning what it called Russian aggression in Syria. And the group linked to a statement in which Khoja says Russia is not fighting ISIS, but rather targeting civilians and communities that have rejected ISIS for the past year. Now, there's been no direct response to that accusation from the Russian government so far, but I did see something interesting on the Twitter handle of President Putin's office, which is @KremlinRussia_E. It tweeted about Putin's meeting today with top Russian officials and said Syria was one of the topics discussed. The Kremlin's tweet also linked to an article with some quotes from Putin. In one of those quotes, Putin says this: "The only way to fight international terrorism is to take the initiative and destroy the terrorists in the territory they have already captured, rather than waiting for them to arrive on our soil." And it's interesting that Putin labels the targets of Russian airstrikes as terrorists, because that's the same label that Assad uses for all of his opponents. Susan?
Thank you, Michael. Oh, would you remind us about those websites?
Yes, you can follow us on Twitter @VOA_IE, and you can tweet to me as well. I am @Michael_Lippin.
Okay, thanks, Mike. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Mars is not the dry, arid planet that we thought of in the past. Today we're going to announce that under certain circumstances, liquid water has been found on Mars.
That was NASA's Jim Green. Using data from the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, scientists found clues of liquid water on the red planet in mysterious dark streaks flowing down the slopes of a number of hills, mountains, and craters.
Our findings strongly suggest that these recurring slope lineae are formed by liquid water on present-day Mars. The spectroscopic detection of hydrated perchlorates indicates that this water is briny and not pure.
Mary Beth Wilhelm of NASA's Ames Research Center says that water found on Mars could be an important resource for those who may someday explore or even perhaps colonize the red planet. I am VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The Palestinian flag will be flying for the first time at the United Nations in New York, and I'm joined on the line by our UN correspondent, Margaret Bashir, to talk about the event. Welcome, Margaret.
Hi, Susan. Thanks for having me.
This is quite significant.
Yes, it is. The Palestinians are a non-member observer state, so technically only full member states fly their flag. So the Palestinians and the Vatican are the only two non-member observer states at the UN. And in September, the Palestinians brought a resolution to the UN General Assembly asking that non-member observer states be allowed to raise their flags at UN headquarters and offices. And despite objections from the United States and Israel and some of their allies, the international body voted 119-8 to allow the Palestinians to fly their flag.
Will this change at the UN have any significant repercussions for the institution?
No, not for the institution, but I think it's a reinforcement of many states' belief that the Palestinians should have a full statehood, and it's symbolic for them, and it's something for President Abbas to show the people back home in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip that, look, we are in many ways a state, and our flag is flying along 193 other member states' flags at the UN.
Well, thank you very much, Margaret, from the UN.
Thank you, Susan.
Coming up on International Edition, a controversial internet firewall and a new single in reggae fusion. The military government of Thailand is steadily moving forward with plans to build a massive internet firewall that would allow officials to censor and conduct surveillance on nearly all digital traffic in and out of the country. But there are growing objections to the plan, leading some to wonder if the firewall will ever be built. Joining me here in the studio is International Edition's Doug Bernard. Welcome, Doug.
Hi, Susan.
Hey, what's this all about?
So for the last several months, starting in about June, the military junta government of Thailand has been issuing these decrees across various levels of government. And what they basically want to do is create one single internet gateway. Now, a gateway is basically like sort of the door, I guess, through which internet traffic passes in and out of the country. So right now, Thailand has 10 gateways, which is about right for a nation that size and that population. But what the government says it wants to do is create a single gateway. What that would allow them to do, much like China does, that would allow them to conduct, I mean, really rigorous surveillance of the traffic, email communications and such that's coming in and out of the country. It would also allow them to really stringently censor the internet if they so chose.
Well, people obviously are going to oppose this because of their own privacy.
There are Thais in Thailand and abroad who've already started various petitions online who say exactly that. They're very concerned about their privacy being violated by this new firewall. Interestingly, there's a lot of business-type leaders, tech leaders in Thailand who are also very opposed to this idea. What they're saying is, look, this is going to slow down internet traffic such that we probably won't even be able to operate in this country anymore. And besides, who would trust us with all this surveillance going on? So there's pushback both, I guess, at the civil level and also at the business level.
And Thailand has a history of this sort of censorship, doesn't it?
Well, Thailand has a history of web censorship, to be sure. They don't like criticism of the government. That extends long beyond this military junta. But also, they've also been very adamant about censoring sites that they consider pornographic. But also, Thailand has some of the strictest lèse-majesté laws in the world. These are laws that prohibit any criticism, mockery, any derogatory comments about the royal family. And the law is written so vaguely that the Thai officials have very frequently blocked YouTube or Facebook, very popular sites, because maybe there was one video that was critical of the king or the royal family. So Thailand has a history of internet censorship, but they don't have a history of something as rigorous and as stringent as this.
I didn't know you knew how to speak French.
I'm full of surprises.
Thanks, Doug, for stopping by.
Thank you, Susan.
This is VOA.
Health news and notes. This is Living Better.
Anemia, or a lack of iron in the body, leads to a reduction in the number of red blood cells, causing tiredness and other symptoms. To combat the problem, a Cambodian-Canadian venture is making a small, cheap iron fish to use inside of cooking pots. The lucky iron fish leaches small amounts of iron into the food and water while it cooks. Users say it helps how they feel.
I used to always feel very tired, but after starting to use the iron fish, bit by bit, I began having more energy.
Devot Haim with Lucky Iron Fish says the tool is made from recycled iron, costs about $5, and lasts for 5 years.
I hope that the Lucky Iron Fish will swim around the world where there is an iron deficiency.
Lucky Iron Fish plans to go global with its product, providing an iron fish to about 1 million families over the next 5 years. I'm Martin Seacrest from VOA's Living Better.
You remember the hula hoop, that thing that went round and round your waistline, and you'd drop it, and you'd fall, and you'd scrape your knees, and then you'd get up, and you'd try it again, hour after hour? Well, hula hoop is making news in the music world, and to tell us about it is the host of Border Crossings, Larry London. Welcome, Larry.
Thank you, Susan. I'll tell you what, Omi has had a great year. Omi was an obscure, little-known artist who came from Jamaica this past year when he arrived with his hit Cheerleader, which was number one for 6 weeks in the U.S. It went to number one on iTunes. And it's actually the song Cheerleader was a song that he had recorded in 2008 and didn't go anywhere until it was reissued, remixed by German DJ producer Felix Jahn. And so now Omi is riding on his success with his second song off of his new album, Me For You. The new album comes out October 16th. And, of course, Hula Hoop is the name of the new single, and it's already reached top 20 in Sweden, Australia, Norway, and Denmark.
How would you describe Omi's music? What category does it fall into?
That's a great question. I'm glad you asked. The experts are calling his style of music reggae fusion. And this is a time when a lot of people are interested in reggae music. This year marks Bob Marley's 70th birthday.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people are just, becoming more aware of reggae music with a lot of things that are going on. But, you know, Cheerleader was number one. And the last time a Jamaican artist had a number one hit was over 10 years ago when Sean Paul hit number one on the U.S. charts. So Omi's had a great year. His real name's not Omi, by the way. It's Omar Samuel Paisley. And his dad called him Omi growing up, so... Mm-hmm. It was kind of a nice little nickname that he stuck with in his career.
The way you move your hips and lick your lips, the way you dip, you got me up so high. And girl, you got that body with them curls like a Bugatti. I just wanna drive. Oh, and girl, you know, round and round your love, it winds me up like a hula hula hoop. Hula hula hoop.
What about the fusion part? What does that mean?
Well, he's not what you don't hear steel drums. Mm-hmm. You hear a lot of electric guitar. You hear a lot of different sounds and different directions, but you know it's reggae when you hear it. You can hear the reggae flavor and the reggae mm-hmm. sound that Omi's creating these days. And so Hula Hoop is a fun song, just as the name would indicate. You know, it talks about the old plastic whammo hula hoop that we all used to go out in the backyard, as you said. And I didn't spend hours trying, but I did try a few times.
Well, what else can we say about Omi?
Well, Omi's getting his second shot at a music career because he tried back in 2012 when he put out his first album. It did well at home in Jamaica. It didn't do so well elsewhere, so he was dropped by the record label. He was signed last year by Ultra Music. And so, as you know, life can be short in the music industry if you don't produce results. And so he is producing results with what I say is his next new album, Me For You, coming out October 16th.
Well, thank you very much, Larry, for stopping by.
Thank you, Susan, for having me.
Thanks for joining us today.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. Trade and Development Agency awarded a grant on September 25th to NextGen Solawazi Limited to support the development of a 60-megawatt solar photovoltaic power plant in Shinyanga, a city in northwestern Tanzania. The grant supports a feasibility study that will evaluate the technical and commercial viability of the power plant, conduct environmental and social impact assessments, and provide the necessary analysis for NextGen Solawazi to seek implementation financing. This project is critically important to Tanzania's economic growth as, according to the World Bank, only 15% of its population has access to electricity. USTDA is pleased to continue our work with NextGen Solawazi to develop renewable energy in Tanzania, said Director Leocadia Zak, who signed the grant agreement along with NextGen Solawazi Limited Managing Director Mayank Bargava. This project presents a valuable opportunity to draw upon U.S. technical expertise to deploy new energy generation capacity in Shinyanga. Tanzania's National Strategy for Poverty Reduction and Growth has identified limited power generation capacity and poor electricity access as the most critical issue for development, said Mr. Bargava. Energy generation from the solar plant will not only electrify an estimated 210,000 households, but also act as a catalyst to attract other commercial enterprises by providing reliable, plentiful, and cheaper electricity. The feasibility study will be undertaken by U.S. engineering and technical consulting company Clean Energy Consulting and Education in Phoenix, Arizona. The project builds upon the agency's previous collaboration with NextGen Solawazi, including the provision of an owner's engineer who is supporting efforts to build a 5-megawatt solar plant in Kigoma, Tanzania. Both of these projects advance the goals of Power Africa, a U.S. government-led initiative to add cleaner, more efficient electricity generation capacity across the subcontinent. The United States is proud to work with its partner, Tanzania, to help provide clean, safe, and renewable energy to meet the needs of a growing and vibrant population.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.